Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you at The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you things of interest, things of science, things of the human mind, and people. One of the peeps in the family. I like that expression. One of our peeps. Dr. Kent Robert Short. Kent, welcome back.
Well, nice to be back.
Nice, and nice to be on the station. My buddy from around the corner who works with us here at the Demel Center in a way of helping us when we have questions. Kent is a board-certified psychiatrist who has done a lot of stuff. Give us just a little of the background.
Well, I've spent years subspecializing in addiction as in psychiatry, as well as and worked for years at the Smithers Treatment Center for Addiction. I have an interest in depression, anxiety, mood disorders, the interconnection between trauma and childhood and addiction. Currently have a connection with Columbia where I do teaching.
You're beholden to no one. Now, there's a reason I say that, beholden to no one. Kent doesn't get paid by any of the drug companies to prescribe any medications. Even those cute little people who come along and they say to you, buy our, prescribe this
absolutely.
More often.
Absolutely. I buy my own pens.
What? You buy your own pens. Thank you. No, thank you. No pens. But that's basically what happens. Here, let's talk about this. And the reason it's important is there are a number of people on the air at our station, WBAI, from Majid Ali to everyone who believes that there is a way to help people who are upset, who are out of balance. You could either help them physically, help them clean up their physical act, or you can help them by talking to them, by being reasonable with them, or by guiding them through psychotherapy. Psychotherapy and the talk cure seems to be pretty terrific. When that runs into trouble, when people find that they don't want to do that, they frequently go to their physician, and the physician says, you know, if you've got this obsessive compulsive disorder, you should take this drug. And your doctor, who's not a psychiatrist, who doesn't know psychiatric drugs necessarily, will make different recommendations. And in his book, he remembers, if a person can't sleep, you give him this drug. If a person is depressed, you give him this drug. In fact, he may be getting some kind of goodies for prescribing Prozac or something else. So he would make certain recommendations, and the physicians make a lot of recommendations. Some nurses are making recommendations for different mood-altering drugs and mind-altering substances. So you go to the psychiatrist, and you say to the psychiatrist, do you know any more than anybody else? And the only difference is, he says, well, this is the thing I study, the human mind, and how the medication affects the human mind. So someone comes to see me, and they tell me they're taking medication. And I would say nowadays, one out of four people who come to me for a consultation are on some kind of medication. My question is, what is that medication? What does it do? I'm not so stupid as to say get off the medication, because I don't know what the effect is of getting off it so suddenly. That's when I consult with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. And I go to him and I say, what do you think of the drug? What do you think of what they're taking? And do you think they should take it more, take it less, or get off it, or switch it? That's where Kent comes in. Here he is, the magic man. So, Kent, let's go over these. Well, first, any comment about anything I've said so far?
No, everything's spot on.
Okay. So now let's take a look at the different kind of ways that people are taking drugs nowadays. Depression, obsessive-compulsive, anxiety, which may be a form of that, bizarre thought disorders, behavior controls, right, and mood swings, giant mood swings. What other categories are there?
Attention deficit, a very popular one these days, inability to concentrate and focus well. A lot of people are looking to get medication for that difficulty.
Because they try therapy. And therapy doesn't work, and they try meditation. you know, and meditation doesn't necessarily help them. They can't calm their minds. And sometimes they'll go for that one, right?
That's right.
What's the most popular depression?
Depression, without a doubt, is probably 80% of the psychiatric medications in the country are in the category of antidepressants.
80% of them?
Yeah.
And if 80% of them since Prozac, which is, I mean, just before Prozac, as well, Buterin and all the other ones, but I guess there's been a real increase since Prozac, hasn't there been?
I think the big thing about Prozac is that it was much better tolerated than the antidepressants prior to that. Once upon a time, you know, in the 80s, 70s, they would have things like Elavil and Imipramine, which you had to get blood levels, and there were some serious cardiac problems and blood pressure problems. So the real revolution with Prozac is that it was a safe enough medication that most people didn't get problems and side effects with, as well as, I think, as you were alluding to before, physicians, GPs, felt comfortable enough with these medication to prescribe them, where the earlier ones, there were, you know, really difficult side effects. So in that way, Prozac and all the subsequent antidepressants have been much safer than the previous ones, much easier to monitor, and much less problems in terms of side effects.
Yeah, so, I mean, your physician feels comfortable enough without having the psychiatric training to say increase it or decrease it because he feels comfortable with dosages even.
That's right.
Now, what percentage of people would you say are prescribed antidepressants by psychiatrists versus general practitioners?
Oh, these days at least 60-70% of the antidepressants in this country are prescribed by non-psychiatrists.
Okay, and I'm sure you, because you bothered to go to school, would say, no, you should do it through a psychiatrist.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that some, you know, as you were talking before, again, if people are resistant to talk therapy, they're resistant to trying other methods. I mean, I think sometimes people in the real world, they have to confront the realities of what people want to deal with. So if somebody's not willing or doesn't want to take the time for therapy or meditation or other kinds of treatment, the reality may be that a medication may be the only thing that they're going to want to look for at that time, in which case then the physician, if they can alleviate some pain in people's life, I think there's no problem with trying out something.
It's pretty hard because, you know, so many people are anti-medications that they stand without anything. You know, they stand without anything. They try therapy, they try meditation, they try green juice, they try oxygen, they try all the other things, and they're still depressed. So here comes a question, and they won't try therapy frequently because therapy means you have to trust somebody. Mm-hmm. And you got to become vulnerable in front of somebody, and maybe they just can't find somebody who's worth trusting, or they don't want to trust anyone.
Okay.
And it's expensive. And the insurance doesn't cover it the way it used to. And a one shot with a psychiatrist is generally covered by your insurance, and then the costs after that are significantly less than therapy. But you do therapy with people, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But the idea that there's a push, particularly, I would say, from insurance companies and HMOs to encourage people to get evaluated for medication and to be on medication. There's no question that's, I think, contributing to a little bit of the over-prescribing of medication, because there is a bit of a push by insurance companies, which I think have their own self-interest to limit the amount of payments for things like ongoing psychotherapy to get people on medication, which is clearly much less expensive for them than ongoing psychotherapy.
Let's go over some of the differences now. Why would a person, besides the fact that the representative might have been cute, why would a person be prescribing Prozac over any of the others? And could you run over the others and say, what indications might you, Kent, have that would say, well, you know, I think we'll try Paxil rather than Prozac? Which one works where?
But, yeah, I think that the trying to figure out if somebody has a depression that may have more of a biological, psychiatric, as opposed to an emotional or psychological component, the mind versus the brain, is a very difficult decision, and it's hard to figure out which is which. But certainly if you're looking at symptoms like the sleep is affected, the appetite is affected, people's energy is affected, those seem to be slightly different than just feeling low self-esteem and blue. So we're looking at, or I'm looking at, some of those kind of markers, which may suggest to me that maybe there is a biological component to their depression, not just emotional factors and the like. And then you're choosing the different antidepressants based on some of the symptoms. Some people's depression tends to be more anxious and they can't sleep, and other people's depressions almost are the opposite. They seem to be sluggish and they're oversleeping. And I think the different kinds of antidepressants vary a little bit in terms of those different subtypes of how depressed people present themselves.
Would you be more specific? For example, Prozac, you were going to say?
Yeah. I think Prozac and Wellbutrin, but Prozac, are two of the more stimulatory ones. They're kind of like caffeinated antidepressants. They kind of energize you. The other category of antidepressants like Paxil, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa, they tend to be a little bit better, I believe, for people who have a lot of depression, of anxiety and agitation in their presentation of depression. So that would sort of have me look to those medications, those serotonergic, which is the subclass of antidepressants, rather than Prozac. Their side effect profile would seem to go along better with the kinds of symptoms that the person's coming with.
So if a person was more depressed and they didn't seem to, they couldn't get motivated, Prozac may add a little caffeine or
That's right.
Affect some energy to it. If a person has an anxiety disorder, if a person has what they call an agitated depression, therefore, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to give them the latter drugs.
That's right. And I think that
Paxil and stuff like that may not be good for them because it might increase their anxiety.
Well, certainly Prozac and Wellbutrin, which are stimulatory, will definitely be not so good for people who are anxious and agitated. The more sedating antidepressants like Paxil and Zoloft and Lexapro are better for people who are a little wound up, the decaffeinated antidepressants.
Therefore, let's go for what I consider to be the single most effective use, more than even with depression, is with obsessive compulsive disorder, where I see people who have these things they can't get out of their mind, which always goes along with a lot of anxiety, and I could see many people like that being treated who are just, you know, they can't stop their minds. They seem to have the best response.
Yeah,
to the medication, even more than just the lift of the depression. You can get their mind to stop.
Yeah, I think that both the mind obsessing on past mistakes, past things they should have done differently, you know, looking backwards with a negative sort of bent about what I did wrong, how I've been a bad person, how I've been a bad therapist, how I've been a bad son, how I've been a bad father. That definitely, that groove that sort of gets stuck in their head about something wrong or bad that they've done in the past, that is lifted a little bit. And then similar to that, the groove that's stuck about worry, which is a future kind of obsession, meaning that there's something about tomorrow and the next day that I have worries about that will be bad. Medical health being one, financial health being another, where the mind just can't stop being out of the moment into the future with a negative bent of something bad's going to happen. The shoe's going to drop and I can't know when it's going to happen. I just know it is. And I think these medications definitely will calm down that negative obsessional thought, which ruins people's quality of life and being in the moment.
So when you sit with somebody and they come to you for an evaluation and they say to you, oh, I'm sent here because I need to find out what kind of drugs I should take, your beginning questions are what? What do you first start with besides what's your name?
Generally ask, again, how they've been feeling recently, you know, ask them just general questions about their name and their life situation, but then go into, you know, that there's something that must be emotionally painful in their life that they're coming to see me about. And so really, what is it that's hurtful? And trying to identify what emotion it is, and sometimes people have a hard time connecting to what it is they're feeling. Sometimes it's a smattering. It's a kind of, they'll say confused, let's say. I feel, you know, unhappily, but I feel confused. And then trying to tease out with them, is it more sadness or blue? Is it more worried, anxious? Is it more obsessionally focusing in on the past and feelings that they've done things wrong or that they've been bad people? And sort of fine-tune what emotion it is, as well as what's contributing to the sadness, and what's contributing to the anxiety, what's contributing to the irritability, if that's another thing that people are coming in feeling that they're irritable and everyone's disappointing them and they're grouchy all the time and it's not winning friends and influencing people. So they want to get some relief with those feelings.
Dr. Kent Roberts, sure. So if a person has... So we've got two kinds now. We have the person who's got a sluggish kind of depression, and we look at them and we consider, we'll look at that and consider some of the Prozac or Wellbutrin or something like that. Then you have the person who's got an anxiety component, but you look at the anxiety component from at least two places. One is it regrets over the past, mm-hmm. that kind of rumination, that kind of depressive rumination, but it's you can't get comfortable. I mean, the whole idea of you can't get comfortable in your skin is part of what motivates them to come to see you. Mm-hmm. And then there's one, either you're worried in the future or you've got regrets in the past. Would you actually choose a different medication for past worries versus future worries?
Not really. I think the kinds of antidepressants that tend to do well with anxiety, my experience is that they do well with both those components of looking backwards in terms of a negative thought process causing current pain about regret and low self-esteem, or looking forward with an obsessional worry about something wrong that's about to happen that's making them feel tense and anxious and uncomfortable in the moment.
Well, but then what's the difference? Why do you have 10 names to choose from? Or why do you choose from 10 different names?
I think that my experience is the vast majority of the antidepressants are interchangeable, to be honest. I think that a lot of them are similarly acting, and if one of them works for a person, the other ones would. So that certainly the non-stimulatory category, the non-Paxil Wellbutrin, I find many of those are equally efficient and work similarly and often have similar side effect profiles. So I use all of them.
Now, there's some work that you've done. I know that you've done some pioneering work with fibromyalgia. Right? And you're interested in fibromyalgia. Now, fibromyalgia, just define it, if you would.
Fibromyalgia is a syndrome of pain disorder, chronic pain disorder, that really is, to my thinking, a ruling out of known causes of pain disorder. So often people will have multiple sites of pain and discomfort, often in the joints and the muscles, and there's a workup by a medical doctor to explore, is it rheumatoid arthritis, is it multiple sclerosis? They rule out a lot of the known medical causes of that, and then they're left with what I think is a wastebasket of a pain syndrome with no etiology. And we call that fibromyalgia. I tend to think for a lot of people that has a very powerful psychogenic pain component, meaning that it's a manifestation of the emotional pain that they're feeling, and that for whatever reason they're more comfortable discussing feeling physically pained or feeling physically tired, let's say, and I think this has a lot to do with people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, and they often go together. They feel more comfortable and connect with physical pain or tired rather than something hurts. You know, something hurts emotionally in my life, and life is tiring me. You know, that life, the worries of my life, the regrets of my life, that's the boulder on my shoulder. But I'm really maybe not even conscious of the fact that that's why I'm tired. I just feel tired. I don't have any zip. I don't have any zest. I don't have any motivation. But it's coming from a sort of psychological, psychiatric weight pressing on them.
And your approach to that is generally a non-medical approach.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Certainly in my work with addiction, a lot of people will find medical doctors start prescribing things like narcotics and opiate derivatives, things that are like heroin. And that can be very difficult for people to get themselves off. You can become quite physically addicted to these narcotics, these painkillers. It will provide some relief of the pain syndrome, I think, for a while. But I find with many of these patients, the pain comes back because you're really not getting either psychologically, where Armand and his group comes in to find out what may be causing the emotional causes of the pain, or psychiatrically, is this a manifestation of a depression or an anxiety disorder? And if that gets relieved with medication, there'll be less of a psychogenic pain or a heaviness about themselves once their mood is lifted.
Now, if you have somebody who's got a lot of body signals, Ken, and a lot of body pain and physical pain, like I wonder about somebody who goes through addiction recovery, if they're going to pull themselves back from a medication, if they're taking a medication, if they're taking drugs, you know, they're going to feel a lot of pain if they stop taking drugs. They're going to feel things in their body, aches and pains and withdrawals and lack of endorphins. That's going to be horrible. The tendency is to give them another drug to take them through, isn't it?
Absolutely.
What do you think of it?
Or just keep them on it, meaning that once somebody has a psychogenic pain, once people have migraines or chronic back pain or facial pain or generalized body pain, and you have them on a narcotic, and you have them on a pain medication, then they're very physically addicted to that medication, and that any decrease of that medication is going to be something the brain is not going to be happy with. The brain is going to react to the lowering of something that the brain has become quite tolerant to, and that lowering of that pain medication is going to cause a certain degree of discomfort. It would cause a degree of discomfort in anybody. Now, if you already have an underlying predisposition to be somatic and to amplify the amount of pain that you feel, you need that like a hole in the head to sort of go through some kind of narcotic or pain medication withdrawal on top of some kind of predisposition to amplify pain, not exaggerate. I don't want people to think that I think people are making up that they're in pain and the like. They're feeling pain, but, you know, psychiatrists like myself would say that there's a lot of complicated things that go on with physical pain and emotions in the brain. It's a very powerful sort of amplification of the pain that's serving all sorts of very complicated emotional and social and psychological purposes. So that if someone's going off these pain meds, they're going to be slightly uncomfortable on top of the fact that they have, let's say, fibromyalgia or some chronic migraines, backaches, or something already on board. So you can see why people have a hard time coming off these narcotics.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, too, because one of the things that the migraine people learn about is a thing called rebound headaches. Nobody understands rebound. What they would do is generally give you medications and then more medication and then more medication. The body becomes used to the medication, and the addiction starts calling for itself. Now, how is a brain going to get Demerol when there is no migraine? It says to you after a while, if it's craving Demerol, I'm going to give you a migraine so you'll give me Demerol. So the migraine becomes the secondary trigger, becomes the thing to get you the drug that you're addicted to. And this becomes a cycle. Because the more you take Demerol or the more you take your painkillers, the more comes the migraine every time you try to stop. And so people have endless migraines.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, with a lot of the pain medication, I think there's no free lunch, you know. There's no sort of treating pain without there being, after the medication wears off, a little bit of the reaction to the fact that the brain has changed somewhat because of the medication. It's become adjusted to it. It's what we say, it's become tolerant to it a little bit, so that when you're starting to come off the narcotic, you're starting to feel a little bit of the withdrawal effect, which is often an uncomfortable pain syndrome, which will, yes, have you reach back for the painkiller.
So we have these treatments for depression. We have these treatments for obsessive compulsive disorder, high anxiety disorders. There's this question about what is mood swings and what really is, you know, what really is it? I mean, is there such a thing as manic depression? And how do you diagnose that? How do you see manic depression versus depressive disorder?
Well, I think people who have manic depression, they have certainly and are aware of a lot of the symptoms of depression, as we talked about before, feeling blue, not getting pleasure from life, feeling anxious. But I do believe there are some people with manic depression who then will swing a little bit into feelings of being somewhat hyper, somewhat impulsive, do things they normally wouldn't do, kind of reckless behavior that you wouldn't see particularly in a depressed person. They often feel agitated. Their thoughts, rather than with depression, your thoughts are usually slowed down and you have a hard time thinking. In mania or hypomania, often the thoughts are racing. The thoughts are going too fast. And sometimes that feeling that's hard to distinguish between anxiety of what we think is a kind of agitation. Like there's a motor running. There's an antsiness. I gotta start pacing. I've gotta walk around. I don't feel comfortable. That kind of motor running is sometimes typical of mania in terms of manic depression. I think it's important for a lot of people to realize that mania is not necessarily a happy experience for people. It's not Robin Williams telling jokes at a million miles an hour and making people laugh. Maybe I'm dating myself a little bit here, but it can be like Don Rickles, you know, somebody kind of irritable and snarky, you know, quite saying kind of mean things and provocative things and certainly biting and irritable and maybe slightly paranoid. So hypomania, if somebody out there is considering whether they have it or someone they care about, again, don't think of it as a happy necessarily component. It can sometimes be quite uncomfortable.
There's a caustic element to it. You know, and now have you found, what I've heard is now people are trying to treat the manic depression, the cyclothymia, with the same drugs they're using for depression. Is that true, or are they... It used to be lithium. It used to be, let's try something that's going to balance it differently.
Well, I think that we're at a place where there is some evidence that the mood stabilizers, a whole different class of medication we didn't talk about. Lithium is the granddaddy that you mentioned, but these days, Lamictal, Topramax, Depakote, Neurontin, they're the newer generation of these mood stabilizers. And a lot of people, like myself, believe that, in fact, they work better on manic depressions which have an element of mania either imposed in the depressed period or they alternate back and forth, they actually work better than antidepressants. And even more complicated is that sometimes antidepressants, I believe, can make people with manic depression worse. It can actually make their mania, particularly the irritability, the agitation, which again doesn't win friends and influence people and make a person pleasant to be around and sometimes doesn't make you pleasant to be in your skin, can make them feel worse in some of those kinds of symptoms.
Which is why you shouldn't pick up your antidepressants or for your friends in the streets, because they may not be giving you the right one. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little music, special music, and then we'll continue with our discussion.
Get ready.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
Go.
Mm-hmm.
John Coltrane, you're listening to My Friends with Miles Davis from Streaming. And you just have to pardon me because I got this fella around here, Kent Robert Shaw, who won't let me go when it comes to jazz. There is a thing about it. You know, Kent, when I was a kid, as you know, I hung out with many of the musicians, and they would talk about dry mouth whenever anybody gave them a medication so they couldn't take it. You know, it's very hard. It was the medication became the music. And the music worked fine for as long as you're playing music. You know, there's no depression, there's no upset, there's nothing as long as you're playing music. But when you get out of the music, you got to pick up something else. You know, a drug, a chemical, anything else to keep you going. We were talking, we started talking about the manic depression and the manic depressive illness. And this is Armand DeMille, in case you just tuned in. We're speaking with a psychiatrist, Dr. Kent Robert Shore, about the thing that people don't like to talk about, which is people who take medication. He's not saying you should take medication. He prefers you don't take medication. He says, but if you do, learn about it. And if he's got to help you with it and you come to him, that's what he does. He says, I will give you a prescription. I will teach you. I'll show you what we're doing here. Now, one of the things that I find the most difficult is that with these new level of drugs, the physicians, the general practitioners have felt free to give prescriptions out easily, saying, you know, this will help your depression. A person walks in, goes to see a general practitioner, he decides he's going to give up Prozac. And there's a problem here, especially when it comes to manic depression. I'd like you to talk about that, Ken.
Well, I think, as we were saying before the break, that manic depression, there can be an agitation and an irritability component. And with these antidepressants, and to be honest, I think that when we're talking about general physicians, the only class of medication that they give out other than tranquilizers and sleeping pills really is antidepressants. They never seem to make the diagnosis of bipolar or feel comfortable making that because it is a little complicated to
Well, what about tranquilizers? Do they give them out anymore? Did they stop giving them out?
Oh.
Valium, Xanax.
They're giving them out like water.
So it's antidepressants. And it's the sedatives, the tranquilizers, and the sleeping pills.
That's exactly what they're giving, and often not giving for somebody who has a bipolar disorder the appropriate medication, which is these mood stabilizers. And as you were alluding to, that the antidepressants can definitely have effect of agitating, winding up people who are already anxious and depressed, and that they often feel more uncomfortable, certainly initially, if not long term, with certain people where the antidepressants are making the hypomania, the agitation of that, the racing thoughts, the irritability worse.
So if a person has a manic depressive illness, and if they have that, but they're being diagnosed as depressive, they could be getting the wrong, number one, medication, and number two, even by psychotherapists, they could be getting treatment that ignores some fundamental organic components, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. They're missing some of the mania that needs to be addressed. If that's causing some psychic pain in their life, and particularly with mania, it's often causing difficulty with other people in their life. Particularly that irritability is a very hard thing because a lot of patients won't come in and say, I'm irritable. They'll just say everyone around me is slow and stupid and annoying. They can sometimes miss that they're irritable, and that's part of what's making their life uncomfortable is the reaction to their irritability affecting their lives.
So nasty may be a symptom of a manic depressive illness.
Absolutely.
And nasty is experienced by other people around you, people who see you that way. Or if you have somebody, if you're in love with somebody who's basically negative, but not just negative, negative in a kind of a caustic way. It's like they're not just depressed, but they're nasty. There's a kind of an edge of anger all the time, and that's what you're calling the manic part, right?
That's right.
Not always. I mean, the mania could manifest in other ways.
Absolutely. But that certainly that irritability and anger that can come out of people is the aspect of mania that causes a lot of discomfort and a lot of unhappiness. I would say the other thing, again, the recklessness, the lack of concern about consequences that could have people spend money they don't have or do sexual or drugs or other things in an impulsive way. They're not thinking through their actions because they're on a fast motor. They're acting impulsively and quickly and thinking quickly and acting quickly. And that's not necessarily a good idea to do as you do things that you then later regret.
You know, you talked about Robin Williams, and we thought of Robin Williams as being cute and benign. But I've seen Robin Williams in his desperation, which he's a self-admitted manic depression. I've seen where it's caustic and angry and mean, you know, in the way he was doing it. It seemed like niggly, you know, like he's coming after you, almost like a bird pecking at your shoulders. So it's not always that you find just the kind of sweetness is one. It really always has that irritability and nastiness to it. If you see that thing, if you see that nasty part of a person, a physician or a psychiatrist will say, maybe this person is good for one of these medications, and we look at these other ones. Now lithium being the old granddaddy, how did lithium work? I mean, what was the idea of lithium?
No, lithium seems to deal with both aspects of the manic depression. It deals with the depression, the symptoms we had talked to about earlier, as well as tempers down the mania part of it. So it kind of tempers the swinging of the moods that seem to swing too depressed, too negative, or the moods that tend to swing too hyper, too agitated, too manic. It tempers them, so the person hopefully still have emotions and feelings, and yet they're not swinging into the zone of depression that's causing some discomfort, or mania, which is causing some discomfort.
But when we get into this class of drugs, and we get into this class, the ones that are used for manic depressive illness, we get into the ones that have the side effects. You know, I mean, side effects from somebody taking lithium are, you know, they're famous. I mean, you know, you could, I hated the way I felt on it. As opposed to the SSRIs and the drugs for the depression, what do they call this class of drugs when you talk about the ones being used this way?
The mood stabilizers.
They're mood stabilizers. And the mood stabilizers, run down a list. Is there any reason why you would use one over another?
Well,
I mean, Neurontin, I've seen overprescribed so much so because I am sure the Neurontin company has people, because I've just watched how many people get flooded with it.
Yeah, Neurontin, like many things in life which is too good to be true, turned out to be too good to be true, because it had so little side effects and so little interactions with other medications, so it looked like the perfect mood stabilizer. And just clinical experience over the last 3 or 4 years, sadly, has been that Neurontin hasn't really been as effective as some of the other medications. We talked about lithium. Certainly the big other ones are Depakote, Tegretol, Topramax, Lamictal. Those mood stabilizers are the ones often prescribed. Now, I think that in terms of side effects, one of the big side effects of this class of mood stabilizers is increased appetite and weight gain. So that is very problematic for
Topramax.
And Topramax being the exception to that.
Is the opposite of that.
That's correct. That's correct.
People take Topramax to lose weight.
That's correct.
And to control migraine.
That's correct.
But it doesn't work.
It works as well as almost anything for migraines. Migraines is a very complicated subject. Sadly, a lot of things don't seem to help migraines.
Yeah. See, so this is one group. Now, if you prescribe this, do you prescribe hoping that you're going to be able to reduce it to get a person off this? What's the idea? If you're treating a mood disorder, are you saying we're going to treat you with this and then we're going to give you psychotherapy and somehow we're going to be able to balance the two and get you off the drugs?
That's my hope and belief. I think, you know, so that people don't think I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth at the same time in terms of therapy and psychiatric medication, I would say that a lot of psychiatric medication, if used not too heavy-handedly, will have people's moods a little bit under their control, better under their control, not narcotized, not stoned, not cutting off their emotions, but enough of their emotional world is available to them that I would say they're now able to do psychotherapy more effectively. Because I think, ironically, a lot of patients in psychotherapy, they sometimes have a hard time digging around in some of the most painful emotions in their past, or looking in a mirror honestly about painful things about their personality or their character that's most difficult to get at. And ironically, if you're kind of depressed and feeling low about oneself, it's harder to really look in a mirror and be honest about some painful, I would say, realizations about yourself. So ironically, the less pain you're in, the more you may be able to dig deeper to really what has hurt you in the past and what is it about your behavior that may be causing pain in your life today. So that, yes, you're going to more effectively use psychotherapy, and then potentially enough of that will grab hold that there won't be a need for the medication.
If you did find your symptoms abating, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that psychotherapy is the only answer. Some people can use a mood stabilizer so that they could learn to meditate. They could do Tai Chi. They could do any number of things that sometimes the anxiety and this mania just stops you from it. It stops you from accessing any of your other powers. So it's not that psychotherapy is the only answer. Hopefully the medication is creating a bridge so that you could get to be medication-free, but also symptom-free so that you could really approach it differently. Another class of drugs. Now, while we're at this, we talk about irritable personalities. Now, what about really irritable personalities? People angry all the time. I mean, angry, just walk around raging, defiant, you know, you've got that kind of thing. I guess they don't come.
You're talking about my landlord? No. Yeah, I mean, people who are very irritable all the time, yes, they can come out of depression, or it could be a sort of bipolar aspect of it. There can be a certain degree of paranoia associated with that, though. You and I were talking earlier that there's a whole class of medication that, at least I feel, is often overprescribed today, and these are the very strong antipsychotic medication that I think some people are getting for, let's say, irritability and anxiety. And I find that those medications, which would include Zyprexa, Risperidol, Seroquel, are very strong medications, often with pretty strong side effects of sedation or a kind of subtle numbing of their emotions. And they're pretty powerful. As the name implies, they're antipsychotic.
Well, so let's talk about what psychotic is. Psychotic is a loss of touch with reality, but it doesn't necessarily mean just because there's a hallucination, right? Or right. You're hearing things or you're paranoid that you're psychotic.
Right.
But if you're hearing things that aren't there and you're seeing things that aren't there, why aren't you psychotic? I don't understand.
Well, I think that...
I mean, I do understand, but I want to...
Yeah, I think that, you know, psychosis being losing touch with reality, you either have a belief system that's not true, that Martians are trying to make me impotent or the FBI is after me, or you have perceptions which aren't based in reality. You're seeing things that aren't there. You're hearing things that aren't there. They're hallucinations. So, that's a rather serious break with reality, like the movie Beautiful Mind, you know, the schizophrenia that they were representing with Russell Crowe in that movie as a very serious psychiatric illness where there's a loss of reality. And these kinds of medications are quite appropriate and necessary when that level of agitation or anxiety occurs, that there's a loss of touch with reality. I just see a lot of people who are prescribed these medications, which I don't see any evidence that the person's ever had a loss of reality. There is no evidence of any psychotic thinking or psychotic perceptions. They seem to be used for just helping people with anxiety or helping people with their irritability.
So then why would they prescribe it? Because it's a big shot. Because it's like hitting somebody with a sledgehammer.
Absolutely.
You know, I think the doctors must get annoyed. I think the physicians must get annoyed with certain people and certain symptoms, and they want to say to them, shut up, there are no voices, boom, and they hit them in the head with a hammer, and they give them one of these drugs, just to keep them quiet. I think some of the physicians, some of the people want to make the family happy because they quelled the storm, but they're not going in to fix it, they're looking to smash it. The antidepressants, the antipsychotics, when you do take them, I mean, there are cases where a person is not in touch. And what would be a classic example of a person who is walking around, who's in danger, who really is not in touch? Not just the one talking about Martians, but persecutory complex to the point where the person is hiding out in their house.
Oh, yeah. I think that sometimes people in a subtle way, you know, feeling like coworkers don't like them. They're talking about me. They're laughing at me. When I walk down the street, people are looking at me in a way that's making me feel like they're thinking bad thoughts about me, or they're thinking I look ugly, or they're thinking I'm a loser. So I think some of that sort of paranoia as it relates to people you know or people you don't know can be fairly crippling to people's lives.
Is obsessive jealousy ever a psychotic symptom?
Yeah, I think that when it gets to the level of suspicion to I know for sure, I think that that's a close line there where I suspect infidelity, jealousy versus I know for sure, I'm convinced. And clearly that can have a delusional quality if it's not true, if it's not reality that somebody is having an affair or somebody is in fact googling at somebody and they're not.
So in which case you're saying, look, your mind is not functioning properly. You've kind of thrown a switch. And you can't hear me say this because while I'm saying it, you know I'm wrong. If you're psychotic, you don't believe that there's anything really wrong with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Psychotic people are absolutely convinced that the things that they're experiencing and perceiving are reality. They don't question them. They know for certainty that that is a pink elephant in the room in terms of visual hallucination, or that the FBI is after me. I know for sure. Or the neighbor. One of the things I hear in New York a lot, I know the neighbor around me is on purpose, you know, banging and trying to irritate me on purpose, doing it all volitionally to upset me.
But if a psychotic patient comes in, I mean, they don't come in, but let's say the family comes in and the mother comes in and says, my son, he's hearing voices coming out of the Venetian blinds, and he believes I put them there. You've got to help him, Doc, and now you'll see him, and they'll come in to see you, which is, I know, a small percentage of the cases you see. But if you see them, how do you get them on medication if they are convinced that you're part of the plot to assault the Venetian blinds with voices?
I think that getting the family involved with both bipolar disorder, the irritability we talked about, as well as things like paranoia, getting other family members involved in the decision process, because often, even if the patient is somewhat disturbed and paranoid, at least there's some level of trust with old friends and family members that will help people to take the medication. But we haven't talked about the need for times, rarely, for psychiatric hospitalization. I mean, these are some of the times where people are so paranoid and have a belief system about the medication that sadly the only thing one can do is to have them out of their own safety and the concern of other people in an inpatient facility.
And sometimes what you've got to do, and I've known that if you get somebody who is psychotic, who does take a medication, sometimes you can see immediate results, can't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Talk about that just a second.
I think within a couple of days or so. I mean, there's such overwhelming evidence for people that have a belief system that there's no evidence and there's no belief that emotional problems are sometimes due to genetic, biological problems. They've never seen what I think is a miraculous kind of change in somebody who's has the illness of schizophrenia or severe bipolar, who within a couple of days will respond to the medication, no longer become delusional, no longer hallucinate. And more than 50 years ago, before these medication, these people lived very tortured and pained lives. And obviously these medications have been very helpful to have these people connect with reality when there's something going on where their mind's playing tricks on them and they start falsely believing things that aren't true.
But you don't give up on them. If they're psychotic, you still think psychotherapy is appropriate.
I think once they're on level ground, I mean, once they're in reality, I think there's lots of interventions that can be help people to not become agitated, anxious, all the things that we know psychologically that can trigger psychiatric problems.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We are here bringing you the positive mind, It's been a very exciting. You know, I think we could have gone on for hours, Kent, which means that we will have to go on for hours. We'll have to do this again. If you wanted to get a copy of today's program, you could call my office, 212-757-4488, or you could go to the website, thepositivemind.com, and download it. Just, we should have it available to you soon, very soon. We'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., thepositivemind.com, Armand DeMille, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, Miles Davis, John Coltrane. Not bad. Tommy Flanagan, too, you think?
Miles Davis Quintet here on WBAI at 99.5 FM. Thank you very much, Armand DeMille, with The Positive Mind. Coming up on 2 o'clock.
You can still vote. Call 1-